Scrapbook for 1938, written and compiled by Leslie Bailey. The pages turned by Freddie Griswold.
The year when we all came to the brink of a precipice. And for those of us who'd fought in the First World War, this was a pretty shattering experience. It was just 20 years since Germany's defeat, followed by her humiliation under the Versailles Treaty. Only 20 years from 1918, our year of victory, to 1938, Hitler's year of victorious brinkmanship.
But when the year began, brinkmanship wasn't in prospect. For those of us too young to be disillusioned about World War I, it wasn't at all a bad time to be alive. Civilization managed to get along quite well, thank you, without purchase tax or nuclear fission or even commercial telly. Greta Garbo was 30 and unbelievably beautiful. Carol Gibbons was on the air. The tunes of the time were entrancingly square. Not a bad time to be alive, unless you happen to be one of the 2 million unemployed. But even they were getting their jobs back. Britain recovering from the great slump of the 30s. Rearmament getting up steam. Not enough steam, some people said. But all in all, the prospect of continuing to be alive seemed pretty good. What did the Prime Minister say right at the beginning of 1938?
I am about to enter upon a fresh attempt to reach a reasonable understanding with both Germany and Italy. And I am by no means unhopeful of getting results, said Mr. Neville Chamberlain in January.
So the year opened in an atmosphere of optimism, and as always, the tunes of the time measured the popular temperature.
Everything's bright and breezy, do as the dog will please thee. Why don't you make your way there, stay there, play there, once you get down that way.
Rubino Lane, any, in Me and My Girl, broadcast from the Victoria Palace, London, January the 4th, 1938.
The broadcast that overnight turned a flop into one of the biggest hits of all time. Me and My Girl were straying to half-empty houses. Then came the BBC broadcast, and from that moment, the telephone in the box office never stopped. And if ever a song became universal, this did.
Prince Obolensky introduced it into New York Cathay Society. A dance teacher went from London to teach it to Mussolini. Even the Germans shouted, Oi! Instead of Heil! Once the Nazis had checked on Noel Gay, the composer's pedigree.
To us at the BBC, the effect of that one broadcast was a revelation. The wireless had become the chief of mass communicators. The BBC had only to broadcast a spelling bee to its 30 million listeners.
Spell hemorrhage in 30 seconds beginning from now.
And spelling bees became the national party game.
This is a national program. Bandwagon, produced by Harry S. Pepper and Gordon Cryer.
The most popular show of the year. Every Wednesday night with the most popular comedians.
Well, now, ladies and gentlemen, Arthur Askey will demonstrate some of the exercises that have made him the fine specimen of manhood that he now is.
Yes. You could have a body like mine in 30 days.
Don't discourage them.
Okay.
Arthur will now do 64 bends in the short space of 35 seconds.
Vive la sport.
Oh, I wish you could see him now. Are you ready? Yes. Then go, please. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3. 3 and a half. Yeah, well, we haven't got time for any more now.
It hadn't escaped the notice of Arthur Askey and Dickie Murdoch that Prunella's tax health and beauty girls were very much in the news.
What's that?
7,693 high kicks a minute, I think.
Ladies and gentlemen. Oh, I wish you could see him now. Are you ready? Yes. Then go, please. 1. Oh, Arthur, your trousers.
Oh, I'm glad you can't see me now.
In its comedy, its news, its commentaries, the wireless was our window on the world. Television was hardly out of its cradle. There was an up-and-coming radio reporter at the BBC 24-year-old Richard Dimbleby.
The usual crowd of Londoners who peep at the guards from Birdcage Walk through the railings of Wellington Barracks had their money's worth this morning when the 1st Battalions of the Grenadiers and Coldstreams showed civilians just how a barrack should be protected from air attack. The normal routine of the morning was going on when just after 10:30 this happened. The squads of men on the parade ground rushed helter-skelter to their gas-proof rooms as the bombs came crashing down. Gas and fire squads ran to the guard room, which a bomb had set ablaze. They slashed at the window to rescue the victims inside. And meanwhile, another sentry detected gas, and shrouded in his oilskins and gas mask, sounded the alarm.
It's only make-believe in February 38, like they do on the flicks. Things to come, H.G. Wells stuff. Seen that film? Science fiction. Let's pretend. What a party.
Mass Observation, a new organization formed to study public opinion, records a wave of hostility in Britain towards all warmongers, armaments tycoons, and scientists. It reports the comments of the man in the street.
These scientists making things like gas to get rid of the surplus population. They ought to be put in jail for it. They will one day.
Liquid gas casualties rushed to the dressing room to be plastered with bleaching paste. The grotesque, sprawling body of the guardroom sentry was carried away on a stretcher, and even the white-hatted army cooks had their gas masks on. In fact, Birdcage Walk wasn't itself this morning, but the spectators at the railings were convinced that the army will know how to look after itself if ever the time comes.
And then, like a ghost at the party, a man came back from the real thing, from the Spanish Civil War, from Barcelona. John Langdon Davis spoke on the BBC.
Here is what happened to a woman janitor of a friend of mine. She was on the platform of a tram. The arm and shoulder of a youth were severed by the explosion and his body dropped at her feet. She pushed it away and sprang from the tram and ran off. She was caught and taken to a hospital. To this day, she cries whenever she hears sirens or even a motor horn. Before that, she was a robust woman of the peasant type.
Deep in the winter plain, two armies dig their machinery to destroy each other. Men freeze and hunger. No one is given leave on either side, except the dead and wounded. These have their leave, while new battalions wait on time at last to bring them violent peace.
Spain in the third year of her agony. 500,000 dead already in the war against fascism. China, drenched in the blood of millions of men and women and children by a ferocious Japanese invasion. Palestine in rebellion against the British. A world of violence 20 years after the Great War for everlasting peace and decency. But in Britain, let's go to the zoo and see the giant panda.
Outlook for Sunday, showery and rather cold in the north, probably continuing mainly fair and mild in the southeast. The late news summary, copyright reserved. Important changes in the German cabinet and high command are announced tonight. Herr Hitler takes supreme charge of all the armed forces. Field Marshal Blomberg and General von Fritz are dropped.
What did this mean? These were Hitler's more cautious generals. What could it mean? All we knew for a fact was that the Führer, who'd been in political power only 5 years, now became supreme warlord. The consequences were to be revealed to us stage by stage as the months of 1938 went by. First, on a dark February day, an unhappy Austrian named von Schuschnigg drove up to Berchtesgaden, the Hitler house in the German Alps.
To von Schuschnigg, anti-Nazi Chancellor of Austria, the Führer said, "Now your hour has come. You shall bow to my will as all the rest of the world shall bow, or I will break you. Austria is alone," said Hitler. "Neither France, nor Britain, nor Italy will lift a finger to save you."
All day Hitler raved at von Schuschnigg, and when the Austrian Chancellor drove glumly back to Vienna, he'd agreed to concessions that were to undermine Austria's independence.
3 days, the city buzzed with rumor, wrote Douglas Reed, the Times correspondent in Vienna. It happened that the government gave a great ball in the old imperial palace, where the champagne glasses still bore the eagles of imperial Austria. And while the guests danced, the diplomats talked together in low voices, and from the corners of their eyes watched Chancellor Schuschnigg and the Nazi, Seitz Inkwart.
It was our last glimpse of the old Vienna. Next morning, the world read the headlines.
Vienna. Austrian Nazi leader, Seitz Inkwart, appointed Minister of Interior.
So, the cuckoo's in the nest. A nice bit of Hitler technique. A Minister of Interior has, of course, charge of police and prisons. Seitz Inkwart immediately orders the release of all Nazis imprisoned in Austria. While these gentry get to work, in Britain we are preoccupied with our own ministerial crisis.
Eden resigns. Foreign Secretary's disagreement with government policy towards dictators.
Speaking in the debate on his resignation today, Mr. Eden said, "I do not believe that we can make progress in European appeasement if we allow the impression to gain currency abroad that we yield to constant pressure."
Appeasement wasn't yet a dirty word. It still had its old-fashioned meaning to pacify. Chamberlain always qualified his policy as armed appeasement. He went on arming Britain at the same time. But Eden couldn't stand his compromising line, more particularly with Mussolini, whose hands were dripping with Abyssinian blood and whose armed forces, like those of Germany, were helping Franco's fascists in Spain, despite a non-intervention agreement.
Another British ship, the Alcera, was bombed and sunk early this morning by 2 aircraft about 20 miles southeast of Barcelona. The captain, officers and crew, and the British non-intervention observer were all brought safely to Barcelona. They say that the planes were marked with black crosses.
Oh, well, the nights are getting lighter, the buds are on the bough, the cuckoo's in the nest. And there's a jolly good new comedian at the local cinema.
Thanks for the memory of sentimental verse. Nothing in my purse. And chuckles when the preacher said, for better or for worse, how lovely it was.
Bob Hope with Shirley Ross in the big broadcast of 1938.
Of Schubert's serenade, little things of jade, and traffic jams and anagrams and bills we never paid.
How lovely it was. We who could laugh over big things, we're parted by only a slight thing.
I wonder if we did the right thing. Oh, well, that's life, I guess.
I love your dress.
Do you?
It's pretty.
Thanks for the memory of faults that you forgave, rainbows on a wave,
and stockings in the basin when a fellow needs a shave. Thank you so much.
Bob Hope's first big success. He came in the spring with the March hares and the Easter bonnets, and the cup final, and Tommy Woodruff quite madly promising to eat his bonnet at Wembley.
Another girl kicks for Huddersfield, and I'll eat my hat at any score before this whistle goes. How long is it?
Just a minute.
A minute ago, and no score at Wembley in the cup final of 1938.
It's a rash promise. In that last minute, a penalty is awarded for Preston.
Here comes Much to take. Much is taking it. Here it comes. And it's a goal! It's a goal! Preston has scored.
Preston North End 1, Huddersfield Town 0. And that night, Tommy Woodruff did eat his hat on television. A sugar one.
The Dorchester, the Savoy, Jack Jackson, Carol Gibbons, Ambrose, Roy Fox. Never was London's nightlife so bright with splendid bands and cabarets. Never its shirts so stiffly starched, its backs so expensively bare.
Franco bombs Valencia and Barcelona again. Barcelona dead, now total 1,300. Spanish government issues appeal for abolition of bombing of open towns.
Nobody took any notice of that. The German air squadrons in Spain were too busy getting in some practice for our turn. And as for us, a rather jaundiced poet said, "The war is swallowed with the steak and fish. These well-fed people have a well-fed way of eating what calamity they wish."
O'clock in the morning, March 11th, 1938, Berlin. The Führer signs a secret directive to his generals. Operation Otto. 0 hour for crossing the Austrian frontier, 8 a.m. Saturday, March 12th.
The weekend. Hitler's favorite time for action.
Saturday. We're sitting in our carpet slippers, listening to Sandy Powell in music hall.
Can you hear me, Mother?
And as we drink our bedtime cocoa, we hear Hitler himself welcomed by the Austrian Nazis. We hear the traitor, Sy Winkwart, that industrious minister of the interior, waiting at the gate.
Mein Führer!
Columns of German armored vehicles are entering Austria without opposition. At midday today, Herr Hitler crossed the frontier and drove through decorated villages to Linz, where, as a boy, he went to school.
When I left this town, Providence charged me with a mission, the return of this country to the German Reich. I have now fulfilled this mission.
Sieg Heil!
Austria proclaimed a province of the German Reich.
Everyone was staggered by the Anschluss, its swiftness, its tactics as crooked as a swastika. As the news filtered through, we heard how von Schuschnigg had tried to hold a plebiscite to show how many Austrians wanted to keep their country independent. But Hitler gave the Austrian government an ultimatum to replace themselves immediately by a full-blown Nazi administration or 200,000 troops would cross the frontier. Schuschnigg gave in, but the troops, the planes, the tanks came nonetheless.
From Vienna, Douglas Reed, the Times correspondent, reports. I went out into the city. The first thing I saw was a procession of motor tenders containing German troops coming from the direction of the airport. Before breakfast this Saturday morning, the Germans had landed 1,000 men in Vienna. I saw Heinrich Himmler, the German secret police chief, drive into Vienna. A stupefied Austrian policeman watched the car go past with its black uniformed occupants and almost jumped out of his skin as a harsh Prussian voice shouted from it, "Donnerwetter, by the devil, don't you salute?" The policeman's arm shot up and he mumbled feebly, "Heil Hitler. He has a lot to learn." All the young Austrian Nazis who for years had been meeting in back rooms now came out in steel helmets and uniforms. I saw them entering houses, bringing men out, driving them away in vans. I heard shots in the night.
In Vienna alone, 76,000 arrested. Jews, Catholics, anti-Nazis, intellectuals, and von Schuschnigg, the deposed chancellor, and his government.
Mr. Gedge of the Daily Telegraph reports, "At the railway station, crowds of fugitives. A train filled up. Then came the stormtroopers. They went through the train with a fine comb and dog whips. Men, women, and children were dragged out and herded off to prison. Those who remained were plundered quite openly of everything in their possession. Money, jewelry, watches, and furs."
The invasion of Austria was a walkover.
"I have seen mass hysteria in many forms and many places," wrote the Times correspondent, "but never anything to compare with this. The good-humored and easygoing Viennese were transformed at a touch of the Hitlerist wand into raving maniacs. An Austrian with whom I watched the scene, a man of pure Austrian blood, turned away from the window, muttering,
I have fairly good nerves, but this is too much for me. What are all these troops and tanks and aeroplanes for? They're not needed in Austria. Look how these people have surrendered their hearts. Don't they see what this means? Don't they understand?
With Hitler's troops occupying Austria, Czechoslovakia was now within the German nutcracker. Adolf Hitler, who as a young man had starved here in obscurity and who never forgot a grudge, was himself in Vienna, the first foreign capital to hold to Nazism.
His demeanor, as he stood about on the balcony of the old Imperial Palace in Vienna, with the delirious multitudes shrieking below, his voice, as he spoke to them, all betokened the man who was coming to think of himself a god, all-powerful, invincible, all-avenging. It was a fearful scene.
The day is ended, little drummer boy. Lights out, what sounded long ago. So close your eyes, my little drummer boy, and dream of the ones that you love so.
On the English radio, Les Allen is singing. In English gardens, comfortable, home-loving men are giving the lawn its first cut of the season.
In London parks, the LCC lays on open-air dancing as the nights get warmer. Austria? Well, after all, people say, Germany and Austria, it's rather like England and Scotland. Hardly anyone thinks we should have intervened. Some people laugh at Hitler and his strutting Nazis. Some admire them. They have cured unemployment in Germany, haven't they? Few of us fear them. Nazism still seems a long way away from us.
You will shrug your comfortable shoulders in England, writes the Telegraph's Vienna correspondent. You will say, bogey tales. When I tell you of Viennese women, whose husbands were arrested without charge, receiving a small parcel from the postman with the curt intimation to pay 150 marks for the cremation of your husband, ashes enclosed, from Dachau.
A long way away from us. Can this be the same world we are living in? The same year of our Lord, 1938.
The very same week, His Majesty's Theatre, London. The first night of Noel Coward's new show, Operette. Four elder sons of the peerage sing a lament for the decline of the aristocracy and the stately homes of England.
Homes of England in Ballydale and Glen produce a race of charming, innocuous young men, though our mental equipment may be slight, and we barely distinguish left from right. We are quite prepared to fight for our principles, though none of us know so far what they really are. Our duty to the nation is only fair to state. Lies not in procreation, but what we procreate. And so we can cry with kindling eyes to manly life we go. One home for the stately homes of England.
While Noel Coward was satirizing the lingering remnants of old England, the American playwright Robert Sherwood at the Apollo Theatre was focusing attention on the new world situation in his play Idiot's Delight.
In every part of the world, the good desire of men for peace and decency is undermined by the dynamite of jingoism, and it needs only one spark, set off anywhere by one egomaniac, to send it all up in one final fatal explosion.
Today, in Parliament, rearmament. Government calls for 5,000 young men to volunteer as RAF pilots. Defence costs to rise by £60 million over last year. The budget, income tax up to 5 shillings and sixpence in the pound.
After the Anschluss, Mass Observation carried out thousands of interviews in the streets of Britain. What could be done about Hitler? Typical replies.
Don't know what can be done. Keep out of entanglements. That's the best.
Stop him next time.
I don't know. These bloody fascists. It's the kids I'm thinking of.
Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, the first full-length feature film by the young genius of Hollywood cartoons, Walt Disney.
With six of its songs in the hit parade, Snow White packs the cinemas with boys and girls and their parents. The children of Britain in 38 have no fear of the sound of an aeroplane. They swap cigarette cards. To them, sixpence pocket money is a fortune, for look at the prices in the sweet shops.
20 aniseed balls for a penny.
Jelly babies, tuppence a quarter.
Hackney licorice sticks.
Gobstoppers a farthing each.
On the wireless, the children of this generation are delightfully impersonated by Harry Hemsley.
These are imitations of three children playing at doctors.
Are you the doctor? Yes. Are you very busy? Yes. Is it of any importance? Yes, it's very important. Will it keep till I've had my lunch? Yes, what are you having? Toast. How long do you think you'll be? It all depends. Are you sure it's very important? Yes, it's very important. I want you to come and see my husband. He's gone out of his mind. What makes you think he's gone out of his mind? He keeps asking for you. Has he a temperature? No, I don't think so. Well, he must have a temperature before I can tend to him. Please see that he has one at once. What am I to do? Keep him in bed. Cover him up with all the clothes you can find. Collect all the hot water bottles. Put them in the bed. And if necessary, put a gas fire underneath. And when he's boiling, send for me.
If the example of Spain was anything to go by, we knew that war would mean, for the first time since ancient barbarism, a deliberate mass attack on civilians. And that's why we looked on the children with particular tenderness. It's why mass observation, recording the voices of men in the street, summed up the mental state of the nation as widespread bewilderment and helplessness.
What can we do about it? Have Hitler's head examined?
Stop wiffle-waffling, that's what I say.
Just keep on arming, I suppose, as long as the others do.
Oh, don't see what we can do.
I'm fed up with it.
Mr. Winston Churchill said in Parliament today, Europe is confronted with a program of aggression, nicely calculated and timed, unfolding stage by stage. And there is only one choice open, either to submit like Austria, or else take effective measures while time remains to ward off the danger, and if it cannot be warded off, to cope with it.
Churchill was not in the government of 1938.
The mind of the Chamberlain government was expressed by the Prime Minister at Birmingham. Neither fascism nor communism is in harmony with our temper and creed, he said. And yet do not forget that we are all members of the human race, and subject to the like passions and affections, fears and desires. There must be something in common between us, if only we can find it. And perhaps by our very aloofness from the rest of Europe, we may have some special part to play as conciliator and mediator. An ancient historian once wrote of the Greeks that they had made gentle the life of the world. I can imagine no nobler ambition for an English statesman than to win the same tribute for his own country.
To make gentle the life of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Richard Tauber, his debut at Covent Garden Opera House, the opening night of the splendid musical season of 38. A singer from Austria, Tauber was from Hitler's birthplace, Linz, in an opera from the old Austria, Mozart's Magic Flute. Now the tragic name of Czechoslovakia enters the calendar. I will ask Alan Bullock, historian and authority on the life of Hitler, to take up the story.
The chief military effect of the occupation of Austria was that one end of Czechoslovakia was now virtually surrounded by Hitler's army. Inside this peninsula, the Sudetenland, were 2.5 million German-speaking people who had once belonged to the Habsburg monarchy. This Sudeten minority, with its grievances fanned by Nazi propaganda, was to be used as a Trojan horse by Hitler to destroy the Czechoslovak state.
2.5 million Sudeten Germans oppressed and tortured by the brutal Czechs.
So said Nazi propaganda. And there were plenty of people in Britain who were prepared to believe that this was the issue. As Churchill said, the grievances of the Sudeten Germans, which were not unreal, were magnified and exploited. But the Czechs knew very well that this wasn't the issue. They knew that Hitler was only using the grievances of the Sudeten people as a lever with which to break up Czechoslovakia. They meant to make a fight for it if they could, and they were on the alert.
One Saturday night in May, a news flash.
Heavy German motorized divisions under General von Reichenau reported massing on Czech frontier.
The Czechs didn't wait to see whether the reports were accurate. They started to mobilize straight away. And for once, Hitler was caught off balance. Britain and France sent urgent warnings of the danger of war, and Hitler had to climb down, issuing denials and explanations, all the more indignant because there hadn't been any German troop concentrations, and he wasn't ready to threaten the Czechs yet. But once they got over the shock of the May crisis, the British and French governments were much angrier with the Czechs than with the Germans, and they were determined to see that the Czechs, by standing up to Hitler, shouldn't drag the rest of Europe into a general war. For that, Chamberlain wrote very privately,
that we could not think of, unless we had a reasonable prospect of being able to beat Germany to her knees in a reasonable time. And of that I see no sign. I have therefore abandoned any idea of giving guarantees to Czechoslovakia or to France in connection with her obligations to that country.
The Prime Minister had his own plan to avoid war. The Czechs must make the maximum concessions over the Sudetenland. Better give way over the minority, who are, Chamberlain argued, after all, German people, than plunge the whole world into war. The British put strong pressure on the Czechs, and at the end of July, Chamberlain announced that Lord Runciman would go to Czechoslovakia to see if he could find a compromise solution. But Hitler sent for his generals and signed a new secret directive for the army, for Operation Green.
Very secret. It is my unalterable decision to smash Czechoslovakia by military action. The execution of this directive must be assured by October the 1st, 1938.
But Hitler was an opportunist. He built up the tension and then sat back, watching, waiting with that sixth sense of his to see how far he could go and whose nerves would crack first.
A test of nerves, with the German generals lining things up for October the 1st, just in case. But of that we knew nothing.
The night is young, the moon is clear, and if you'd like to go walking, dear, it's delightful, it's delicious, it's lovely. I understand the reason why you're sentimental, 'cause so am I. It's delightful, it's delicious, it's lovely.
every young man's favorite blonde poppet, Francis Day, in the summer show at the London Hippodrome, the fleets lit up.
Let yourself go, so please be sweet, my chickadee. And when I kiss you, just say to me, it's delightful, it's delicious, it's delirious, it's delectable, it's dilemma, delimit, deloop, the top, it's delovey.
The story going round this summer was that awful Adolf was in such a paddy with the Czechs that he got down and chewed the carpet at Berchtesgaden. In England, we were more interested in Don Bradman chewing up the bowlers on English cricket ground. The greatest batsman in the world, said the sports writers. But this year, England had a champion worthy to challenge the Don.
The scene, the test match at the Oval in August. The commentator, Howard Marshall.
Oh, this morning Hutton's gone from 300 to 332 in an hour and a quarter. He's been in for 12 and a quarter hours. It just hardly bears thinking of the amount of strain that's involved. Hutton's total, 332, it sounds like the total of a whole side. The England total, 707 for five. Now here's Fleetwood Smith again to Hutton. Hutton hits him. Oh, beautiful stroke. There's the record. Was the most lovely stroke, a late cut off Fleetwood Smith's leg break, which absolutely flashed to the boundary for four runs to give Hutton the record, beating Bradman's record made at Leeds in 1930, 334, beating that record for the highest score ever made by an individual in test matches between England and Australia ever. Terrific reception. The whole crowd standing up and cheering all around the ground. Thousands of them all standing up. Bradman's been rushed over to shake Hutton by the hand. The whole Australian team have congratulated him. Oh, it really is a wonderful scene, this. Here in this brilliant sunshine, they won't stop cheering.
Summer of 38, a record at Wimbledon. Helen Wills Moody, USA, wins the ladies' tennis final for the eighth time.
August, holiday month for everyone. The lights along the promenade, the spot dance in the pier pavilion.
For Prime Minister Chamberlain, no holiday. To 10 Downing Street come the dispatches. Lord Runciman has failed to find a compromise between Czechoslovakia and Hitler.
To the Gaiety Theatre in London comes Leslie Henson in the last show ever seen there, Running Riot. It's a good year in the theatre. Emlyn Williams joining the front rank of our playwrights with The Corn is Green, a prolific Priestley with no less than three plays on in London. And 82-year-old Bernard Shaw laying the foundation stone for the National Theatre.
Do the English people want a National Theatre? Well, of course they don't. They never want anything. They've got a British Museum, but they never want it. They've got a National Gallery, but they never wanted it. They've got Westminster Abbey, but they never wanted it. But now that they've got it, now that it stands there as a mysterious phenomenon that came to them in some sort of fashion, they quite approve of it.
And in 38, at the Little Theatre, they've got Herbert Fargin's review, Nine Sharp, which becomes quite a national institution itself. One of its great hits is Richard Haydn as the strangest phenomenon of the 20th century, the only living fish mimic, Mr. Edwin Cobb.
After my first fish mimicking recital, a startled scientific world subjected my great gift to a searching examination. And it was discovered that the lifelike reproduction was caused by my fawn moustache, which, falling as it does, outwards and downwards, to the extent of 1 1/8 inches, forms a sort of natural baffle ball. I did not discover my great gift until, as you see, late in years. Since that day, my life has been one long extravaganza. Since making my fish-mimicking debut, I have been classed by those in the know with such uncanny phenomena as the Colossus at Rue, the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, and the Changing of the Guard. I will now give you a demonstration of one of my most superhuman feats. I will imitate the call of the red-bellied gudgeon or blushing fish. This call is so high in the sky as to be completely inaudible to the human eardrum.
This rather cheery summer of 38 had a stately occasion, a trip to France by King George VI and Queen Elizabeth. The king laid a wreath of poppies on the tomb of the unknown warrior under the Arc de Triomphe in Paris, where exactly 2 years later, Hitler was to come as conqueror. Now in 1938, all the military reviews, banquets, and receptions are intended to symbolize Anglo-French solidarity. But Hitler, looking down from Berchtesgaden, busy whipping up the wall of nerves against Czechoslovakia, sees only a facade, screening two nations uncertain of themselves and militarily weak.
"Until we are as strong as the Germans," writes Chamberlain to his sister, "we shall always be kept in this state of chronic anxiety."
In August, 900 RAF planes hold the greatest air maneuvers ever. A test blackout plunges the Midlands and East Anglia into darkness.
Foreign correspondents report, Germany building warplanes 6 times faster than Britain and France put together.
Everyone is waiting for Hitler to speak at the Nazi Party rally at Nuremberg in September. Some correspondents predict that he will declare war.
"I keep racking my brains to try and devise some means of averting a catastrophe," writes Chamberlain. Nuremberg. The Führer delivers a speech dripping with venom towards the Czech. "Now I go before my people as its first soldier, and behind me there marches a different people from that of 1918.
No declaration of war, but William Scherer, famous American correspondent, reports from Prague,
"War is very near, and since midnight, we've been waiting for the German bombers. Much rioting in Sudetenland."
And then, on September the 14th, with 17 days to go to Hitler's secret date for Operation Green, a dramatic surprise.
The Prime Minister has sent to the German Führer and Chancellor the following message. "In view of increasingly critical situation, I propose to come over at once to see you, with a view to trying to find a peaceful solution. I propose to come across by air and am ready to start tomorrow."
Next morning, Neville Chamberlain, 69 years of age, made the first of his flights to Germany. In fact, the first flight in his life.
The Daily Mail said, "The British nation unreservedly places its complete trust in the Prime Minister."
And that was typical. Mass observation reported that 90% of the British public was behind him.
The Premier stepped from his plane onto German soil carrying a rolled umbrella. He motored up to Berchtesgaden. Rain and mist hid the view of the Alps from the panoramic windows of the paranoic Führer. With an interpreter, they sat down for a nice cup of tea.
Chamberlain said, "I have often heard of this room, but it's much larger than I expected."
"It is you who have the big rooms in England," said the big bad wolf.
"You must come and see them sometime," said Chamberlain.
"I should be received with demonstrations of disapproval," said Hitler.
"Well, perhaps it would be wise to choose the moment."
At this, Hitler permitted himself the shadow of a smile, and they got down to business.
"I did not see any trace of insanity," noted Chamberlain.
but occasionally he became very excited and poured out his indignation against the Czechs in a torrent of words. At one point he seemed to be saying that he was going into Czechoslovakia at once, so I became indignant, saying that I did not see why he had allowed me to come all this way and that I was wasting my time. He quieted down then.
After 3 hours, Chamberlain was off back to England, where the eager microphone awaited him at Heston Aerodrome.
I've come back again. Rather quicker than I expected. Later on, perhaps in a few days, I'm going to have another talk with Herr Hitler. Only this time, he has told me that it is his intention to come halfway to meet me. He wishes to spare an old man another such a long journey.
The Prime Minister returned to consult his cabinet, believing that Hitler would agree to a peaceful and orderly amputation of the Sudetenland under international supervision.
Chamberlain worked hard to get the agreement of the British and French governments, and in turn the British and French governments put heavy pressure on the Czechs to submit. When the Czechs refused, they were told that this would mean a German invasion, and if so, neither Britain nor France would give them any aid. So very reluctantly, the Czechs gave in. The Czechoslovakian government stated today, "We have submitted in order to avoid greater losses, misery, and bloodshed. We shall not attempt to throw blame where it belongs, but leave this to the judgment of history."
On September the 22nd, 9 days to go to Hitler's date for invasion, Mr. Chamberlain is boarding his aeroplane again, en route to meet the Führer at Godesberg, smiling confidently at the movie cameras and waving his famous umbrella.
But as he flies away, rather more people are having qualms. 40%, according to the pollsters. A London bus conductor, interviewed, says, "What the hell's he got the right to go over there and do a dirty trick like that on the Czechs? Who'll trust us now?"
Germany. At Cologne, the crowded and cheering streets are hung with Union Jacks and swastikas side by side. Steel-helmeted troops present arms. The Premier drives to Godesberg, to an hotel overlooking the Rhine, for his second meeting with the Führer.
And like a dog wagging its tail with a well-recovered bone, he places the settlement at Hitler's feet, only to be told that this solution is no longer any use.
Hitler had raised the stakes. Now he demanded immediate military occupation of the Sudetenland to lines drawn by himself on a map, no international supervision, unconditional surrender down to the last peasant's last cow, and no compensation to dispossessed Czechs. Chamberlain felt cheated. Angrily, he told Hitler that he was behaving like a conqueror, not a negotiator. So Godesberg ended in deadlock, and the Premier flew back to England.
And in Prague, all the street lights suddenly went out. It was another Hitler weekend, and this time it was coming nearer home.
Czechoslovakia mobilizes. France calls up reservists.
If France, what about Britain?
September the 24th. A warm Saturday evening, a light drizzle falling on London. And under the trees in the parks, we are still dancing, despite the drizzle.
The Ministry of Health announces that 34 hospitals in the London area have been allocated as clearing stations for air raid casualties.
Saturday evening. A night out of the pictures for many. Robert Taylor in A Yank at Oxford. Wendy Hiller in Pygmalion. Lost Horizon, The Lady Vanishes, 60 Glorious Years. Strange how normal everything seems in London. Only occasional scraps of overheard conversation. A man passing me in Regent Street. that Hitler ought to have his head examined. A newsvendor's poster outside Queen's Hall. Europe on the brink. The usual cues for the prom concert. A woman behind me. I work in an office, she says. But they don't talk about it. They're all sick with fright of it. It's a crisis every day. Let it come, I say. It'll be the end of everything, but who cares? And then she adds, contradicting herself, it's the kids I'm worried about. I pay my 2 shillings. I walk into another world. Sir Henry Wood, with his beard and his carnation, conducting. That wonderful man. Celebrating this year his 50th year as a conductor. And at the piano, Mozevich. Another world. Another level of life. The graceful circle of seats that is Queen's Hall, packed to the roof, and the young promenaders standing there watching and listening, and living for just a little while on this other level of life.
Local authorities throughout Britain today began the distribution of gas masks for civilians.
My heart fills with thankfulness for this other world, a world of truth and beauty, a world without fear. But how have we come to this? Sometimes humanity is very hard to bear.
A few days later, a bust of Sir Henry Wood was unveiled at Queen's Hall to commemorate his half-century of service to the cause of music. The same day, they started evacuating children from London.
The dancing stopped in the parks, and thousands of unemployed found work at last, digging slit trenches. Searchlights were mounted, and a few guns, a very few. It was found that all London had only 60 fire pumps. ARP men industriously whitewashed trees at the roadside. Everyone was buying electric torches. Stocks of strip cellophane for windows sold out. Quick marriages at registry offices jumped fivefold. And there were some profound bits of advice on the wireless.
The Home Office announces that the designing of gas masks for babies has been difficult, but this has been surmounted and production is now in hand. In the meantime, a good measure of protection can be afforded by wrapping the baby completely in a blanket, when it could, with safety, be carried through gas to the nearest gas-proof shelter.
Is life on earth a viler thing than ever was known before? Who shall we ask? The wise old man whose years have reached 50? When we have questioned church and state, is there anyone else to ask? Is it the baby, 3 weeks old, that wears a gas-proof mask? Is it the infant, armed to meet a poisoned earth and sky? A thing too weak to lift its hand to rub a sleepy eye?
In Berlin, during the next days, the Führer was in another raging fury.
The British ambassador and Sir Horace Wilson called on him with a warning not to rely on British neutrality. The Führer shouted, "If England and France strike, let them do so. I am prepared for every eventuality. It is Tuesday today. By next Monday, we shall be at war.
Britain declares state of emergency. Hospitals cleared for casualties. Reservists called up.
The BBC received a prearranged signal from the government, and at once, gas-proof doors appeared inside our buildings. Outside entrances were sandbagged. Emergency news bulletins in many languages were transmitted all round the clock. Never before had the world listened to itself slipping over the edge. On September the 27th, the King was due at Clydebank to launch the noblest vessel ever built in Britain. He remained in London with his ministers. His queen went instead to give that ship her own name, Elizabeth.
The King bids the people of this country to be of good cheer in spite of the dark clouds hanging over them and indeed over the whole world.
That night, the Royal Navy was mobilized.
All round our coasts, it was the end of the holiday season. Those who hadn't already gone home hastily packed their bags. It was the last dance in the Pier Pavilion.
Stop press. Premier to speak to nation and empire tonight.
How horrible. Fantastic. Incredible it is that we should be digging trenches and trying on gas masks here because of a quarrel in a faraway country between people of whom we know nothing. You know already that I have done all that one man can do to compose this quarrel. After my visits to Germany, I realized vividly how Herr Hitler feels that he must champion other Germans, and his indignation, the grievances have not been met before this. He told me privately, and last night he repeated publicly, that after this Sudeten-German question is settled, that is the end of Germany's territorial claims in Europe.
But, the Premier said, Hitler's latest demands were unreasonable. Any attempt to dominate the world by force must be resisted.
Under such a domination, life for people who believe in liberty would not be worth living. But war is a fearful thing. And we must be very clear before we embark on it that it is really the great issues that are at stake and that the call to risk everything in their defense, when all the consequences are weighed, is irresistible.
Many citizens of London, Paris, and Prague went to bed wondering whether within 24 hours their cities would be in flames. The following afternoon, the Premier addressed a specially recalled House of Commons. He said he'd sent a last appeal to Hitler. Just then a note was passed along the benches to him. He read it out. An invitation from Hitler to a four-power conference at Munich with Daladier of France and Mussolini of Italy. Czechoslovakia was not invited. The news was flashed out by the BBC.
The whole House rose, cheering and waving order papers. When the cheering had subsided, Mr. Chamberlain continued, I hope the House will release me now to go and see what I can make of this last effort, and perhaps we may meet in happier circumstances. The House adjourned until Monday, amid scenes perhaps unexampled for enthusiasm and emotion.
One MP, Harold Nicholson, called it a lamentable exhibition of mass hysteria. Anthony Eden walked out. But they were not typical.
That evening, a new show had its premiere at the London Palladium. It was called These Foolish Things.
Pitter-patter, pitter-patter, here comes the rain. Let it pitter-patter, let it pitter-patter, don't mind the rain. He'll mend your umbrella, then go on his way, singing toodle-looma-looma, toodle-ay. Toodle-looma-looma, toodle-ay. Any umbrella's too mild today.
Next morning at Heston Airport.
When I was a little boy, I used to repeat, if at first you don't succeed, try again. That's what I'm doing. when I come back, I hope I may be able to say, as Hotspur says in Henry IV, out of this nettle danger, we pluck this flower, safety.
He'll patch up your troubles and go on his way, singing toodle-looma-looma, toodle-ay, toodle-looma-looma, toodle-ay, and the umbrellas to mend today.
At Munich gathered the leaders of Germany, Italy, France, and Britain.
Without consulting the Czechs, they agreed to hand over to Hitler 11,000 square miles of their territory, with all the Czech fortifications and many of her industries, severing her railways and forcing her undefeated army to retire. This so-called settlement was presented to the Czechs as a fait accompli, and next day the German tanks rolled in. It was October the 1st, as Hitler had always intended. Operation Green, but without the fighting. 6 months later, in March 1939, Hitler was in Prague and had destroyed the Czechoslovak state.
But how many foresaw this in 1938 as Chamberlain flew back to London to 40,000 letters from people who believed he'd saved the world from war? I myself described his landing at Heston Aerodrome for the BBC television service. Nearby houses had put out the flags they'd last flown at the coronation. It was a wet day. The Premier came out of his plane, holding his umbrella, smiling cheerfully. Members of the cabinet greeted him. He was given a letter of congratulation from the King. Then he spoke to the microphone.
This morning, I had another talk with the German Chancellor, Herr Hitler. And here is the paper which bears his name upon it, as well as mine.
The famous scrap of paper, promising to resolve all future difference by consultation. I remember a young airman by my side saying, "I'll believe that when I see it." But doubters must have been 1 in 100 that day. And so through dense crowds all the way to Buckingham Palace.
The Times newspaper says, "No conqueror returning from a victory on the battlefield has come adorned with nobler laurels."
He appears on the balcony with the King, the Queen, and Mrs. Chamberlain. And then at 10 Downing Street.
People are surging madly around him, trying to shake hands with him through the car windows, trying to get a sight of him. Photographs are being taken. People are waving flags, newspapers, hats, anything they've got. The car's come to a dead stop now, just in front of the door of number 10. Police on horseback are trying to keep the people back who are going mad, trying to pat him on the back, trying to shake hands with him, cheering him as he gets out.
He appears at a first-floor window.
Everybody's saying shush, trying to quieten the crowd so that Mr. Chamberlain can make a speech. I'm afraid you won't be able to catch his speech very well, but if he does speak, I'll try and convey something to you of what he said. He's holding up his hand now for the crowd to quieten down.
My good friends, this is the second time in my history that there has come back from Germany to Downing Street peace with honor.
I believe, added the Premier, it is peace for our time. He said later that too much should not be read into words used in a moment of emotion, and that Britain must go on rearming. But he wasn't the only one to feel emotional immediately after Munich.
The Sunday Dispatch described Neville Chamberlain quite seriously as a fairy prince. The Archbishop of Canterbury said on the radio that the prayers of the nation had been answered.
Adolf Hitler, personally entering Czechoslovakia to the rigid fascist salutes of his supporters, declared that the Almighty had blessed them all.
Godfrey Wynne wrote in the Sunday Express, "Praise be to God and to Mr. Chamberlain." I find no sacrilege, no bathos, in coupling the two names.
Chamberlain dolls appeared in the shops and sugar umbrellas, but some people were not quite so sure about all this.
The Reverend Leslie Weatherhead asked, "Do you feel as though you had made friends with a burglar, on condition that if he took nothing from you or your immediate friends, you would say nothing about what he took from somebody else?"
And the London Star said,
"A deep yearning for peace is shot through by dismay at the humiliation of surrender."
In Parliament, Attlee denounced Munich as one of Britain's greatest diplomatic defeats. Duff Cooper resigned from the government. Some 30 Conservatives voted against their leaders, including Eden, Harold Macmillan, Robert Boothby, and Churchill.
Alexander the Great remarked that the peoples of Asia were slaves because they had not learned to pronounce the word no. Let that not be the epitaph of the English-speaking people.
The night after the Premier's return from Munich was the last night of the promenade concerts conducted by Sir Henry Wood.
With the crisis over, we felt we could sing the traditional last night songs with good heart that night, October the 1st, 1938. We were not to know it was the last of the traditional last nights ever at Queen's Hall.
A month later, in November, came the greatest shock of all in this year of shocks. A 17-year-old Polish Jew shot an official of the German embassy in Paris. This was the signal for a vast persecution systematically organized by the Nazis.
In Germany, in Austria, in Sudetenland, shops, synagogues, homes wrecked by Nazi thugs, while police look on. Looting, terror, torture, murder, all outside the law. All Jewish cultural institutions and newspapers closed. Refugees flee to the forests and frontiers. Jewish children expelled from German schools. 60,000 Jews deported or sent to concentration camps.
Marian Anderson, the coloured singer, at the Albert Hall in London, in the same week as the Nazi pogrom of the Jews. These, then, were some of the happenings of 1938, just 20 years after Germany's defeat in war and humiliation under the Versailles Treaty. 20 years of resentments, plus the Hitler poison injected into an easily led people, had brought them to a high fever of racialism, nationalism, and militarism. And now it brought 20th century man to the tragic dilemma voiced by Charles Morgan in his play of the year, The Flashing Stream.
The misery they want to cure by force is the misery they have created by force and will create again.
As we stood at the brink, This we began to realize, even if too late to avoid it again. We had looked at the monster human folly had created and knew what to expect. Inwardly, we were this much changed by the year 1938.
And outwardly? Well, outwardly, no change. The year Lambeth walked its way to its end in appropriate British fashion. At Bellahouston Park, Glasgow, where 12.5 million people had seen the Empire Exhibition, the Scots closed it down by dancing the English Song of the Year in pouring rain with umbrellas up.
Scrapbook for 1938 was written and compiled by Leslie Bailey. In addition to the personalities mentioned in the program, those taking part in this recording were James McKechnie, Philip Gard, Olive Gregg, Lockwood West, and Dudley Rolfe. The pages turned by Freddie Griswold. Production by Vernon Harris.